I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Martin Sheen. Download the MP3 of our produced show with him at onbeing.org. Hello?
Hello.
Hello, is that Martin Sheen?
It is, yes.
Hello, it's Krista Tippett. It's so wonderful to have you at the other end of the microphone.
Hello, Krista. I'm delighted to meet you.
Thank you. I hear... Chris, do you hear it sounds like a cave. Is that because something was
a
open?
Cave.
How do I sound to you?
You sound great.
Oh, actually, you sound good, too. Yeah, I'm just so thrilled, but I don't want to talk about anything substantive until we get the sound right. So tell me something mundane, like what you had for breakfast.
Well, I'm having it here at the studio.
Okay.
I'm in the middle of a cappuccino.
Oh, good. Did you just wake up?
No. I was up at 6:30.
All right.
I don't usually eat much breakfast.
Okay. Chris, how are we? What do you think? Okay, good. We can go. Do you have any questions for me before we start?
No. I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed your book that I read some weeks ago, and how I related to your journey, particularly your time in Berlin. I was on a tour with the Living Theater in 1961, and we played in Berlin just weeks before the wall went up.
Yeah.
And, I just found that extraordinary how you spent all those years, with the you were working for the American ambassador, and then you were involved in the planning for peaceful means of nuclear weapons. Would I be correct in saying
that? I kind of. I think that may be exaggerating my contribution, but I think 1961, before the wall went up, there was probably some similarity to when I arrived in the 80s, when the wall was about to come down, and of course no one could have imagined that, but there was all this movement, this fluidity, and isn't it amazing? It's a vanished world, isn't it? I mean, I can't.
Yeah,
my children don't really believe the stories I tell them about Berlin. They just don't believe me. Well, that's great. Well,
yeah, I remember that summer we were traveling to the east on the S-Bahn. And as soon as you crossed the western border into the east, it was like going back to the end of World War II.
Yeah.
There were still, shells of buildings in some of the main streets. It just looked like they swept up the rubble.
Yeah.
And they were, and we went over there to visit the Berliner Ensemble Theater.
Yes.
We were invited
with the Brecht
there.
Children.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We met.
And I met them too. They were still, Eckhart Schall was still running it when I was there.
Oh, well, I met the mother, Helen Weigel, Bertolt Brecht's wife,
Wow. Okay. Well, that's have you been back since? Because the S-Bahn was
back.
Still like that in the 80s when I arrived. It was still that changing worlds when you went over.
Yeah.
Well, I've so enjoyed really steeping in your work, in books that have been written about you and that you've contributed to, and going back and watching episodes of The West Wing and watching The Way. So I'm a Martin Sheen expert right now.
Oh, okay,
and,
good.
It's been great. One thing I would love, before we start, for you to say your name, your legal name, the name you were born with. I want to hear you say it.
Oh, yes, me llamo Ramón Esteves, a.k.a. Martin Sheen.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. So one thing that's interesting to me is it seems to me that, especially when you were playing President Bartlett on The West Wing, journalists have written a lot across the years about your progressive politics. And Catholics here and there have paid attention to your religious foundations, which in fact underpin your progressive politics.
Mm-hmm.
I experience you to be a very integrated person, have an integrated experience and conscience. And so, I just want to say that as we start, I'm looking forward to speaking. I feel like there are these two people who the public knows. There's Martin Sheen and Ramon Estevez. And I want to talk to both of you, or all of you, as it were. And I feel like that's who you live as, but I'm not. Well, I don't feel like this person gets drawn out all the time. So here we are.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good deal. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah. Because I do feel sometimes I live in a split personality, you know.
Well, okay. We'll see what we can. We'll unite that. Yeah. So you grew up in Dayton, Ohio. Now, I've seen I'm kind of confused. I've seen you're the seventh of 13 children, or that you had 10 children at home. In any case, you had lots of siblings.
My mother actually had 12 pregnancies,
okay,
and 10 survived. Yeah,
right.
There were nine boys and one girl.
Okay.
And I was a seventh son,
mm-hmm,
yeah. My brother Alfonso, God rest him, and I argued over the legacy of the seventh son because he was the seventh birth, but I was the seventh to survive. There was a male early on that did not survive, so I shared that with my dear brother Alfonso.
I see. So there's this question I always ask when I start an interview, and I'm interested to know how you would start to describe the religious and spiritual background of your childhood. How would you describe that now?
Well, it was the foundation, really, of the rest of my life. You know, I was raised in a large, very poor family of immigrants. So I was the first generation Spanish-Irish. And so, you know, that really set the focus for the rest of my life. And we had a phrase when I was young in our community that, you know, one serves oneself best by serving others first. Mm-hmm. And that stood me in pretty good stead the rest of my life, because it was always a question of community. Where if you were doing well, and I mean well by you were living an honest life, you were a part of a community. And when you were not, you had drifted from that community. So I drifted kind of in and out, you know. But as a boy, the staples of my life were my family, my church, and school, and they were all integrated. You couldn't separate one from the other. My teachers were as much my family as my blood relatives, you know. We had the Sisters of Notre Dame at this little community in Dayton, Ohio, Holy Trinity Parish, and they were a great source of inspiration. And, you know, they were as poor as we were. You know, their fathers were carpenters and bricklayers and mechanics and so forth, factory workers, like our parents were. So we identified very, very closely to them.
Hmm. You know, when I look at your life, the way the trajectory of your life, and, you know, the story of your, I'd say the development of your social and your spiritual conscience across adulthood, it's very much a kind of classic story of, you know, how, you know, there was hardship, but how hardship often leads to what are gifts, and it's not so much what you're given, but how you take it in and work with it. There's this great line from the beginning of The Way, this film you made with your son Emilio. Where he says to you, "You don't choose a life, Dad, you live one." And I was watching that as I was kind of in the midst of preparing this, and I thought, well, that's your story. Right? I mean,
you know, that film was a family enterprise, really. We couldn't get any funding from a studio to do it, so we borrowed the money, literally, and did it ourselves. So
really?
I'm very, very proud of that film. In fact, it's the thing I'm most proud of in my whole career, you know, because it is a reflection of who I am and where I come from and what I stand for. And I just to make that film with my son, who wrote it and directed it and played in it, you know, and my wife produced it. And it was a whole family affair. And it was the most gratifying experience I've ever had as a professional.
Mm. Well, we'll talk some more about that pilgrimage. I do want to talk about that. You know, in your own family, when you were growing up, when your mother died when you were 11, and which is very hard, and it sounds like your father raised all of you on his own.
Did,
You've said somewhere that caddying was where your social conscience began to be formed. Can you say some more about that?
Very
and I
clear.
Guess that was a job you had to take because you all had to work to keep the family going.
Yeah, we
going.
Did. Yeah, yeah. I started caddying. I hate to admit this because I'm going to reveal my age, but I started caddying in 1949 at a private country club. Hmm. And those were very formative years. I spent my whole boyhood, but at least every summer, early spring till late fall, at the golf course caddying, you know, for a lot of very overprivileged people, mostly
right.
The men. But I'm very grateful to them because in large measure they taught me what not to be. It just became a matter of course, you know, that you were a servant. And they rarely saw you as a person, you know, and so they would tell stories in front of you and talk about each other. They, you know, and you were kind of a fly on the tree on the golf course, as it were, a bumblebee.
Wow.
But you got a sense of these people. And it was not, in few exceptions, you know, there were some really extraordinary people there who were conscious. But most of them were overprivileged and unaware, you know, and so they were not our inspiration, you know.
Right, right. And then it's so interesting to me that, you know, you say you had a movie habit early on, but you weren't really, I mean, you were kind of the expectation in your life is that you would do some kind of manual labor, but you couldn't do that because you had had this forceps injury at birth.
Yeah.
I wonder if that movie career would even have been a path you'd walked into.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way because I never really had a consciousness about what I wanted to do, and yet I knew. And I think all children know at a very, very young age something about themselves, deeply personal, that it's almost impossible to communicate with any understanding to anyone else. But I had this as well, and I started going to movies. I guess I was around 5 or 6, and gradually it dawned on me that I was like one of those people I was looking at on the screen. And it was a revelation, and it was a great sense of peace overcame me as a child because I knew that it was possible that I could do that. In fact, it was more than I could do that. It was that I was that already. Sort of embraced it. Yeah, I knew it. Mm-hmm. And it was like, fine. I was worried about this business deep inside of me that I could not communicate. Oh, that's what it is. Fine. All right. Well, and I just sort of waited until I was, you know, old enough to pursue it. Mm. And I did, you know.
And then I think you, like a lot of people, you became less religious or less overtly religious as you left home and ventured out in your career.
Yeah.
Is that right? I mean, it just
wasn't stopped being.
I mean, this is what your passion was. And
it was interesting
to me that you discovered the Catholic Worker in New York. But I sense it was not so much as a devout Catholic as a starving actor.
Exactly, yeah. I was working at the American Express Company as a stock boy down on Lower Broadway in Manhattan, and I got fired just a few weeks before Christmas.
Huh.
And then a week or so later, I got hired at the Living Theater by Julian Beck and Judith Malina, who were two of my first teachers, really. They had a very powerful influence on me the rest of my life. They were extremely involved in social justice work and in political radicalism. You know, they were the first Band the Bombers and Women Strike for Peace. And they were just a great source of inspiration to me. And I started at the theater as a curtain puller and a general understudy, and they didn't have a lot of money. In fact, I was paid $5 a week. This was in 1959, but I was worth every penny.
Yeah.
And at any rate, they said, look, we know you can't live on this, but we have a friend who has a soup kitchen nearby, and You go down there, and you don't have to pay anything, and you just wait online, and they'll feed you 5 nights a week. And they did, and I went down, and I found – at that time, they were on Christie Street in Manhattan. And, yeah, it was the Catholic Worker.
And was that friend of theirs, Dorothy Day, or was it someone else who –
Yes, the friend was Dorothy Day. She had done some prison time with Judith Malina. They were very close friends. In fact, each one of them wrote about the other in their autobiographies. Yeah, they were in the women's prison. They did 30 days together for protesting nuclearism. And, yeah, that was the national religion at the time.
So interesting.
But, yeah, and so I started going there, and for months and months I went there. I had no idea. I could have met Dorothy Day, but I couldn't tell you because I wasn't there for any other reason but to satisfy my hunger. Yeah, and then one day I said, you know, you guys are so kind, and I'd like to pay you back a little bit. How can I help you out? And they said, oh, well, come on Sunday, we were folding our newspaper. I said, you guys got a newspaper?
Right.
Oh, yes. And it was the Catholic Worker, of course. And that was that cemented my relationship with I became very close to the Catholic Worker and to all the workers across the country. In fact, I'm very dedicated to the Catholic Worker here in Los Angeles.
Right.
My friends.
I think I just recently... I think Dorothy Day, did she die in 1980s? Does that sound right?
Yes, 1980.
Some reason, I didn't realize that she had that she'd been alive until 1980. I had this idea, then. I was alive then too. But
yeah, no, she founded the Worker with Peter Moran, I guess, about 1934.
Yeah,
New York City. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it seems like you had. You know, you worked hard. Obviously, you did the starving artist thing, and you worked your way up to a very successful career. Kind of as you got into your 30s, you were in Badlands, directed by Terrence Malick, and co-starred Sissy Spacek, and then you did Apocalypse Now in 1977, and that was the kind of this classic human drama where you had absolutely arrived at some kind of peak, and you also hit bottom.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
You had a near-death experience. And here's, you wrote somewhere, even though I did not physically die that night of this kind of near-death experience, which was the kind of rock bottom, the Willard character in me died. So talk about, like, what was going on with that role and what was going on with you?
Well, I think it was, it was such a deep and personal conflict deep within my being. About the battle that all of us face in our lives if we're trying to live an honest life. We know when we're dishonest, and that experience brought it out. I was desperate to be a movie star, and I thought this was my opportunity. I was working with the greatest American filmmaker and Francis Coppola, and I had the lead role in this very, very powerful drama.
Captain Willard.
And at the same time, I was dealing with my own personal limitations, my brokenness, my fear and resentments and insecurities, and they both collided on that production. Yeah. And it led eventually to an awakening that eventually brought me back to Catholicism.
It sounds like you had, you had a health crisis, you had kind of an existential crisis, but then it's not like you had this, road experience on the road to Damascus. I mean, it was a couple of years there, it sounds like, where you were kind of reckoning with this and kind of into the 80s. And then, so you've kind of described this arc of you're in the Philippines doing this Apocalypse Now, this remarkable picture, and then a couple of years later, you kind of come full circle in Paris. Is that right?
Or when you did
the movie before that, you did the movie, also the Gandhi movie. It's interesting to me how your film projects and your acting projects. they also, I don't know if it's that they converge with where you are personally, or maybe it's this thing of not choosing your life but living it. It seems like you are working with whatever your life experience is, and for you that life experience included these film projects and these dramatic roles, which took you kind of out of yourself or to a larger place.
Yeah, I've often said that if I knew going in what awaited me on Apocalypse, I would have passed.
Really? Yeah.
But since I went through that experience, I wouldn't change it for the world, because it brought me to myself in ways that maybe nothing else could have at the time. I survived a physical illness, but I didn't know if I could have survived a spiritual crisis. Mm-hmm. And that made it real clear how much was at stake. So, yeah, between Apocalypse and Gandhi, there were about 4 years.
Yeah.
And they were years of reflection and alcohol abuse and insecurity and anger and resentment and a near breakup with my family. And but I was searching for that elusive thing that all of us search for. Most of the time, we're not even conscious of it. But we're searching for ourselves in an authentic way. We want to recognize the person we see in the mirror,
yeah,
and embrace that person with all the brokenness and lackluster, all the things that only we are aware of in the depths of our being. And that's what I was offered an opportunity to deal with when I finally arrived in India in 1981 to do this part in Gandhi. I was only there about 5 or 6 weeks, and mm-hmm. my son Emilio accompanied me. And that was the turning point, because I saw a poverty very up close and personal that I could not have imagined, and it really went to the center of my being and took me out of myself.
Right.
And that's what changed my life.
Right. Yeah. So there'd been that inward journey and that inward reckoning, and then this also took you back out again, and those things came together, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I came home from India really shaken, and I remember bringing some books on Indian philosophy and Hinduism and nonviolence and all of the energy that was mine to absorb during that period.
Yeah.
And as soon as I got home, I had to go straight away to Paris to start a film that I had gotten my signals crossed. I didn't realize I had to be there so soon, but I did. And no one could go with me because the kids were in school, and so it was February of 81. And while I was in Paris, during that very, very sensitive period, I ran into an old and very dear friend who became my mentor, really, and that was Terrence Malick,
mm-hmm.
who was living in Paris, very kind of underground, extremely shy man to begin with. But this time in his life, he was doctoring a lot of scripts. That's how he made his living. But he didn't surface. I had done Badlands with him in 1972. And he was celebrated for that when it opened in 1974. And then he did an equally impressive film called Days of Heaven. And then he kind of disappeared.
Yeah.
But he was on the same kind of journey, I guess, I was. But he saw in me this struggle. And he, I guess for lack of a better term, became for me a spiritual advisor. And we talked endlessly. Whenever I had a free moment, I was spending it with he and his wife in Paris, and Michelle, who has passed away, incidentally.
And he gave you the Brothers Karamazov?
Yes, he would give me material along the way. He said, well, Martin, I think you're ready for this. And he'd give me material. We'd talk about that. And then he'd give me another book. And the final step, I guess, in my journey was the Brothers Karamazov, yeah. And that did it. It got me in ways that I could not have imagined. I stayed up nights. It took me a week to read it, and I couldn't remember what version I'd read, English version, translation, but it was over 1,000 pages.
So yeah.
And then I finished it on, I remember very specifically May Day in Europe is a big celebration. Yeah. It's like our Labor Day. Yeah. And I had off from work that day. I'd finished it the night before, and I knew that I had to respond to this need within me that was now at a very critical crossroads, and that is, all right, where do you go from here? And I walked, I was living in the Left Bank at that time, and I walked over to this little Catholic church. It's the only English-speaking church in all of France, I discovered later, but it's St. Joseph's. It's just off it's on the Rue Mayreau. I may be mistaken. But at any rate, they built a new church on top of the old one. But I was in the old one, and it was the church where Oscar Wilde converted. And I learned that later. I said, "Well, I think I came to the right place." Yeah, and I came. I came back to Catholicism, and it was the single most joyful moment of my life, because I knew that I had come home to myself, and in deeply personal ways, this satisfaction has lasted all these years. I'm still on the honeymoon. Go figure.
It's beautiful. I wonder.
But see, I didn't come back. I was afraid to come back to the piety of my youth. You know.
Yeah.
I wanted the sacraments, I wanted the community, but I didn't want to feel like I was under a microscope and that God was watching me and looking for me to make a mistake, and now I got you, you know.
Yeah.
That was the old church. Since I left, there had been Vatican II and many changes, but there'd been many changes in me personally, and so I knew I wouldn't be happy with piety. It had to be an active spirituality. And so I felt like I came back to the church in a new way. I mean, I was now aware of Daniel Berrigan and Philip Berrigan and the peace movement and Dorothy Day and Mother Teresa and Teilhard de Chardin and Thomas Merton and all of the heroic heroes of the Catholic Church
to communion
the
of saints.
20th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's the communion of saints. So I knew that it was going to cost me. I knew that it wasn't about, you know, it wasn't a free ride. It was going to be very, very costly. And it was, and it is, and it will continue to be, I hope, because anything worthwhile has to cost you something. Otherwise, you're left to question its value. So
I want to keep going on that. I just want to ask you a couple questions before we do that. One is, just imagine people who are listening to this may not have ever read The Brothers Karamazov, or may have read it 20 or 30 years ago in college. I mean, it's a great novel.
I wouldn't recommend it unless you want your life changed.
Say a little. I mean, it's a great novel that weaves into the great debates of his age about God and free will and morality. But could you just say a little bit about what was it in that book that galvanized you?
It's about the reality of commitment. It's about knowing that you're living an honest life and knowing when you're not, basically. Okay. And it's about family. It's done within family and community. And it's not something that you can easily shake. It's not a work that you can put down and pick up something else and not reflect. You'll find yourself going back to it again and again and again. It was Dorothy Day's favorite book as well. Yeah, she read it on a number of books. She would reread it and talk about it and write about it, yeah. Dostoevsky had a grip on the reality of life as it is. And he was a habitual gambler. He was not, you know, a celebrated man in many respects, but he longed to live an honest and free life because that's really where we find the presence of God, or the one, the other, whatever we express as a higher power. That we are part of a community, and that work, Dostoevsky's work, specifically in that book, is about being a part of a community and not being able to let it go without a severe penalty.
And I think that points at something, a dynamic that I sense, which is, you know, on the one hand, you're talking about this call to activism, which you followed after that. But also there's the inner work, and those two things go together. And love mm-hmm. is a word you use when you talk about, you know, that conversion, that experience you had. You know, you said somewhere, I was almost 41 years old before I had a sense of being loved. So yes, it's mm-hmm. that outward giving, but it's also something so profound that's happening inside you. And I mean, was that sense of being loved, was that also a new realization that you had about being Catholic that hadn't been?
Well, Catholicism was a very clear reflection of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I didn't mean to imply that I had never felt loved. No, I was deeply loved. I happened to be married to one of the great people I've ever known in my life.
Right. I think you're talking – but I understood it to be a kind of love, a quality.
Love that I long for, and I think all of us really long for, mm-hmm. is knowing that we are loved. Mm. A knowingness about our being that unites us to all of humanity, to all of the universe, that despite ourselves, we are loved. And when you realize that and you embrace that, you begin to look at everyone else and you can see very clearly who in your vision knows they're loved and who does not. Mm. Mm. And that makes all the difference. And I began to give thanks and praise for that love. You know how so often people say they go on this journey, and I said it too, that I'm looking for God. I'm looking, but God has already found us, really. We have to look in the spot where we're least likely to look, and that is within ourselves. And when we find that love, that presence, deep within our own personal being, and it's not something that you can earn or something that you can work towards. It's just a realization of being human, of being alive, of being conscious. And that love is overwhelming, and that is the basic foundation of joy. And we become enviable, joyful. And then we see it in others, and we seek to ignite that love in others. You can't do it. You can't force someone to realize they're loved, but you can show them. And,
right.
And most of the effort we make is just by living our lives, by being compassionate and loving and respectful and being a vassal of service for others. That's what feeds that love.
Right.
It's like giving back. But just that embrace, I sometimes, you know, it is so overwhelming at times, this reality of loving oneself because one is loved, that it brings you up short. You just sit and stare sometimes into a vacuum and say, where did this come from? And why is it so clear? And why is it so simple and so powerful? And anyone that's experienced it knows that. And there's no remedy except to embrace it and keep going and to try and share it. You know, I've sometimes, one of the great mysteries that I experience at Mass is the reception at communion, you know. How do we embrace that? How can we possibly consciously understand what that is? And I don't have a clue. I just stand online and say, I'm Ramon, called Martin, your friend. You're welcome here. And I'm with them. Whoever the crowd is I'm getting online with, you just look at the people who are on that line, that community, that is the greatest and simplest expression of overtly trying to explain this mystery I'm talking about, because it is a mystery.
Yeah.
It is probably
yeah.
the most profound mystery in all of universe, this love. And but I just say, I'm with them, yeah. I'm with whoever this community, the old and the young and the rich and the poor and the black and the white, and the crippled and the disturbed and the happy and the sad. And all of these people are standing online. Sometimes I'm overwhelmed just watching people online to embrace that sacrament. It is the most profound thing. I never, ever can get over it. It's just something you have to surrender to. And just saying, yeah, I'm with them. That's the community of saints.
And that is your... That's the basis of and the kind of that embeddedness in that sense of love and that sense of belonging, that sense of community is then the foundation from which you got very engaged in the world in a different way. And also yeah. I'm so interested
it's,
in...
It's experiencing true mm-hmm. personal joy.
Okay. And yeah. and working on hard things, right? I mean, also experiencing joy and fighting against injustice.
yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's I couldn't do it if I... You know, all the demonstrations I've ever been on have been nurtured and inspired and performed in this arena of joy. And so when I would go to a demonstration, no matter what the issue or the cause, it would always be prayerful and joyful. I would never take it personal mm-hmm. with the guards or the police or whoever I was being arrested by. It was never, ever, ever took it personal. In fact, I remember my first arrest with Dan Berrigan in New York. We were protesting nuclearism.
And he was a Jesuit priest and
yes,
he became
he's still
well
with
known
us.
As a Vietnam War protester in particular.
Yes, later, he went to prison. Yeah. He burned draft files at Catonsville, mm-hmm. Maryland, and went to federal prison with his brother Philip for several years for opposing the war in Vietnam. And he was the greatest source of inspiration for me when I came back. He was underground after he was found guilty, and he stayed underground for months. And every now and then he would surface to a peace group or a community. And once he was asked by someone in one of these groups, oh, yeah, Father Berrigan, it's all well and good for you to protest the war in Vietnam and to choose to go to prison. You don't have any children. What's going to happen to us? What's going to happen to our children if we go to prison? And Daniel Berrigan responded, what's going to happen to them if you do not? So that that's the kind of inspiration that
yeah.
I had to embrace. With Dan Berrigan changed my life. I've often said that Mother Teresa drove me back to Catholicism, but Daniel Berrigan keeps me there.
Well, you have collected these comrades and these living saints, I feel. So Mother Teresa, tell that story about Mother Teresa driving you back.
Which one?
Tell your favorite. When did you actually first encounter her and how? This journey you were on, where did she come in?
I met her not too long after my reconversion.
In
if
Paris?
I recall. Gosh, I'm getting... No, I met her in Rome, actually, during the first Gulf War, which would have been 1991, I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
So you've already...
A dear friend of mine, who's my attorney, my criminal attorney also, he's one of my heroes, Joseph Cosgrove, who was an attorney in Wilkesboro, Pennsylvania, a public defender. And, you know, public defenders usually are assigned to a case where the defendant is photographed committing the crime. So, you know, they are given the most difficult cases of all, and they do them for very little money. So most of the time they're just trying to keep their clients alive. And he had five of them on death row that he had served. But at any rate, he called me one day and said, look, I'm on a peace mission to end the war in the Gulf. This is the first Gulf War. George Bush won
five's
war. And he said, would you join me? I will. I said, what are you going to? He said, well, meet me at Aitalia tomorrow here in New York. And we're on our way to work to end this war. Okay, I said. So the next day I met him at Aitalia in New York. And he said, oh, great, here we go. We're on the plane now. I said, where is everybody? He said, "No, it's just you and I." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I'll tell you on the plane." So he devised this program. He had a friend who knew Mother Teresa, and this friend got us an appointment in Rome. She was on her way to establish a community in her home, and she was stopping in Rome to collect some sisters, bringing some sisters from India, and on her way. And meanwhile, she was going to see the Holy Father and spend some time in her community in Rome, and we had an appointment to meet her and say, okay. So we went to this place in Rome, and it was a former chicken coop, and this was her community, and we were shown around, and we went in the in the back of the church, in the vestibule, and suddenly the door burst open and she walks in. And when you see Mother Teresa, have you met her?
No, no, sadly, I never met her, no.
Yeah. Well, she was about 4'10", yeah. And so most people, except children, would tower above her, and you'd look over the top of her head, and that didn't seem right. I thought she was 10 feet tall. So I crouched down, you know, and you burst into tears. Mm. That's the next thing that happens to you, is you grovel to say who you are and why you're there and so forth. And she could be the most disarming human being. Oh, no, 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 sit down, sit down. No, no. Now, where are you from? You want a Coca-Cola? How about some coffee? No, now, why are you here? And the three of us sat around. This is Joe Cosgrove and myself and Mother Teresa sitting at a little card table in the back of this little chapel in Rome. And Joe explained that he was going to offer his services to the Vatican to end the war in the Gulf. You cannot go to the world court as an individual. You have to go as a country. And so the Vatican was the only country in the world, and people forget that it is a country, yeah. And the Pope is a head of state. And Pope John Paul II was advocating, mediating the dispute in the Gulf between Saddam Hussein and George Bush. And so he offered his services, and they would take it to the world court. And neither of the belligerents would go. So Joe said he would represent the Vatican pro bono if Mother would get the Pope's permission to do that. And Mother heard the proposal, and she said, "The World Court? I never heard of the World Court." And Joe said, "Oh yeah, it's been in existence for quite a while." And he explained how Nicaragua took the United States to the World Court to stop their Contra war in Nicaragua, and the United States would not represent itself. Mr. Reagan had an empty chair there, and Nicaragua won that case, and the United States never paid the fine because they didn't recognize the court. They do now, but right. The Reagan administration did not. At any rate, now we're dealing with the Bush administration, and the Vatican was willing to do this, and Joe explained this to Mother Teresa. And Mother Teresa looked off very wistfully and said, "The World Court," she says, "and how do they make them obey?" Which was a key question.
Good question.
And Joe said, "Oh, no, Mother, it's a moral victory. That's all it is." And she said, "Well, I would do that, and I will mention it to the Holy Father. And meanwhile, you'll come here to Mass on Friday morning, will you? We're having a Mass in English." "Yeah, we will," we said. And so we stayed in Rome, and we attended that 6 a.m. Mass. And during the prayers of the faithful, when everybody was asking for intentions, you know, to pray for this one and pray for that one, Mother Teresa said, "And let us remember to pray for all those we promised to pray." And by the way, the war ended that morning. Hmm. And Joe said, "Don't mess with Mother." That was my first encounter with her.
Well, and I have to say, you did, and I did not know this about you until I kind of got into this preparation for this conversation. You got arrested a lot protesting the wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua. I mean, at one point you said you got arrested every Wednesday morning.
Yeah,
was
we
that,
had the
was
Wednesday
that in LA
morning
or where
coalition,
was that?
Yeah, at the federal building. We would meet at La Placita every Wednesday morning with this coalition that included, priests and rabbis and people from all over the community. It was mostly a leadership bunch. Father John Deere.
Yes, who I have met, yeah.
Yeah, Bishop. Mm-hmm. You know John, yeah. He's an old dear friend of mine.
And
And Father Olivares, who led the thing, who's deceased now, God rest him. And so many religious leaders, Father Michael Kennedy, and Greg Boyle.
Oh, yeah. He's a friend.
All these guys led these things. And we would block the courthouse entrance protesting the war in El Salvador, and we'd be arrested. And I had a backup. I had like 13 arrests at one time before I got a court date. And it's federal because it's a federal building, so you come before a federal judge. And she said, because I'm always arrested under my real name, Ramon.
Right, right.
I have no ideas, Martin. So she said, Ramon, it doesn't seem if I put you in jail, it isn't going to make any difference. You're going to continue. You're hell-bent on this protest, aren't you? I said, I'm afraid so, Your Honor. She said, well, will you do community service? I will, I said. And she sent me to the Bread and Roses homeless cafe in Venice, and I was there for 10 years.
And that was Sister Rose Harrington, right?
Sister Rose.
Another one of your saint comrades.
One of my, God rest her, yeah, another one of my heroes, yeah. Mm-hmm. She founded this unique homeless kitchen where they served at tables with flowers, and you had to have a reservation because that told us how many to expect, but it also was a great source of dignity for our guests. She said, we call everyone Mr. and Miss or Mrs., and they are our guests, and they're the only reason we're here, and we treat them with respect and dignity. And I did, and it was the longest job I've ever had in my life. 10 years. In fact, I only had to leave to go and do the West Wing.
Well, I was going to say, were you working? Were you acting at that point?
I was acting a lot of different things, but that hit me. I had to leave to go and do the West Wing. Mm.
So obviously no one with your kind of criminal record could ever have been elected president.
No, thank God.
But I did love it that in those years, what did you say? Did you have like a business card? You presented yourself sometimes, the acting president of the West Wing?
The acting president of the United States. Yes, yes. A friend of mine, Matt Clark, came up with that, and I liked that a lot.
Yeah. So that was from 1999 to 2006, seven seasons.
Yes, it was, yeah. It was one of the best of times. Yeah?
Yeah,
yeah, it really was, yeah. It was a great experience both professionally and personally and spiritually and every other conceivable way. That cast and production staff, Aaron Sorkin, of course, created it.
Yeah.
And I think the greatest writer of our decade, really, and Tommy Schlamme, producer, John, I'm forgetting names. I shouldn't go in these areas where I can't remember people.
Okay.
But we were on the air seven seasons, and it was really the best of times, yeah. I only asked two things of the production when I got the part.
Yeah.
And that could the president be Catholic, and could he have a Notre Dame degree?
Really?
And they gave me both, yeah. I wanted him to be Catholic so that I could personally relate to every issue in a moral frame of reference. And I wanted Bartlett to do that, even with the death penalty and with the issues of war and peace, all of it. I wanted him to be known to be a practicing Catholic, and he dealt with things in a moral frame of reference.
I was
inspired by that with Jimmy Carter.
Oh, okay.
In fact, he was one of the inspirations for the character of Bart. There was Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and John Kennedy.
Okay.
Not bad source of inspiration.
Yeah, and I wondered, it feels like it was hard for me to believe. I actually went digging around to see, did you help write, and no, I read, Aaron Sorkin wrote it. But it felt so much like your character was woven into that you embodied this character of President Bartlett. But somehow that your own bodily commitment to public life and to this place where politics meets social justice became also part of your stature in that role, which influenced people well beyond, you know, the way most TV dramas influence people.
Yeah, you know, I can't say that I was conscious of that at all, frankly. I was once asked if I would have done the part if Bartlet had been a Republican.
Yeah.
And I remember without hesitation I responded yes as long as Aaron Sorkin wrote it. Because I knew it would be fair and honest.
Yeah, it's a little hard to imagine,
yeah.
But...
Yeah, it is. but I would have. Yeah, if Aaron had written it, I knew that it would be an honest interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And that you insist on being Catholic, that's interesting. I mean, I went back and watched the pilot, and, you know, I think it's 18 minutes in, the White House chief of staff, you have not appeared yet, but the White House chief of staff.
No, I don't appear to the last scene.
He says, this president is a deeply religious man.
Oh, I don't remember that line, but yeah.
So, I mean, there it was. Your wish was represented from that very beginning. But a deeply religious, deeply Catholic, and also deeply politically progressive man, which is not actually a Catholic. It's certainly a huge tradition and lineage in Catholicism, right, as we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily the kind of Catholic that's made the news in politics in the last couple of decades, which is interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yes, true. I would say I was less religious and more, at least in a personal effort, towards spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to be defined by a religion and to shake that kind of mantle, you know, whatever the religion is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what is more unifying, because unfortunately religions so divide us these days more and more, but spirituality unites us because it's about our humanity, and that's where I think we really have to come together. You know, we're very close to, we're in Advent now, and one of my favorite Advent quotes is from Thomas Merton. I have it pinned up on my wall at home. It was in a birthday, a Christ birthday card. It was a Christmas card from Daniel Berrigan, and it had this quote. May I give it to you?
Yes,
please. This is Advent. Here's what we're dealing with. This is Thomas Merton on a Christmas card. Into this world, this demented inn, where there is absolutely no room for him at all, Christ comes uninvited.
Yeah.
That's Christmas.
Right.
So, you know, when you talk about religion or spirituality or, you know, keeping Christ in Christmas, you know.
Yeah.
Who wants to deal with that? You know, I love that phrase. That quote is my favorite Merton quote.
I like that.
Into this demented inn. But Christ comes, you know, God comes to us uninvited.
Yeah.
We're not out there looking, waiting for him. You know, we think we are. No. I have another phrase I use so often when I'm faced with having to do something that I know I have to do, and yet I want to put it off, procrastinate a bit. It's we must accept the cup as offered, not altered.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we always want to, could you pour some out, please? It's so full. Or could you put a little sugar in there, please? Or maybe not today. Can I take some tomorrow? No, I'm afraid not. We have to accept it as it's offered. And so that's what I think the full embracing of spirituality is really about. It's about a consciousness that is not always expressed in religion.
Right.
But it is in our humanity.
Yeah, and obviously it was I see when people write about the West Wing, they often have to remind themselves that it was a television drama and not actually what was happening in the White House. I see people catching themselves.
We were a parallel universe the actual Bush administration for most of those years.
Yes, yeah. And where was I? Yeah. Read so many interesting things, like Hillary Clinton just a few years ago being a Secretary of State in Burma, and the politicians there telling her they were watching the West Wing to learn the ropes of democracy. Did you know that?
Oh, my God. No, I never heard that. Oh, my God. Her husband was a great fan of the show.
Oh, well, yeah.
Supporter. Yeah. And then kind of the gates closed as soon as the new administration came in. But we got our licks in with Mr. Clinton. He was a devotee of the show. He loved the show.
Well, and I think, you know what, I think even though obviously these were scripts and you were acting, but there was a lot of, you did confront as an actor and with those scripts the complexity and really the messiness of bringing religion, as you're saying, into politics and into political mm-hmm. issues, that it is unbelievably
Well, another
complex.
Word for it, I think, mm-hmm. is to be human.
Right.
To
the
project
messiness.
Ourselves. Yeah, it's about being human. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have the answers to mm-hmm. very many, solutions for our problems. But I'm acknowledging that they exist, and I'm acknowledging my, limitation. But I embrace it, and I'm going to do what I can while I'm here. I think that's basically all anyone can do ever in any situation is to be human, to be available, and to be confident in making a contribution for its own sake. Most of the people would never know what you're going to do in your life, you know. It's not recorded. You know, we do it for ourselves, and the only ones that know about it are we and those closest to us, and that maybe as it should be, you know. There's one of the great phrases in AA, we are encouraged to do something for someone that costs us something and never tell anyone.
Okay.
And it's not talking about costing us financially, you know. It's like we have to go out of our way for each other for our own sake. You know?
And that kind of human presence as a spiritual discipline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I wondered if I just want to ask you a question, if I may.
Okay.
How, if, may I?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, if you don't mind, is this business of prayer.
Yeah.
Do you ask people in your interviews if they pray or how they pray or what they pray or what does prayer mean to them? Have you ever gone into that?
It certainly comes up, but it's not a question I would just ask somebody out of the blue, 'cause it's the most intimate question, right? And I think I believe there is many ways of praying as there are lives, right? And that even across the course of a lifetime. And I mm-hmm. think prayer also is connected to our personality type. You know, I mean, I think there's people for whom common prayer feels more natural and some for whom it's private. And so I think...
This is the most curious element of the spiritual life. I'm always curious about how people pray. And what images they use to go to that place where they can pray. And what does prayer mean to them? What do they expect or why did they do it? Aren't you curious about that? I know that you are, but I just wondered if any guests have ever explored that with you a little more deeply.
Yeah. Well, we did a show early on just about prayer and with some really different kinds of voices, you know, Anushka Shankar, Ravi Shankar's daughter, who talked about Hindu chant and the prayer, you know, how that is a form of prayer. And Roberta Bondi, you probably don't know her. She's a Methodist theologian, and she was at Emory for a long time. And she studied the Desert Fathers and Mothers, and she talks about, you know, prayer as just being present to God, right? And she talked about how in real life, with the people we're closest to, you know, presence is often just about, you know, it's about reading in the same room, right? Or it's not mm-hmm. necessarily about talking or asking. So it's about relationship. So, I mean, I have, yeah. it's so interesting to pull this out. Is it something across your life that has, do you
yeah,
feel that prayer has changed a lot? Or,
yeah,
or
you know, one of the most curious questions in the New Testament is the friends of Jesus saying, teach us how to pray.
Yeah.
And he gives them the Our Father. That's the only prayer that really comes to us from the Master.
Yeah.
And how interesting that those men at that time, or at least the people in his community, asked him how to pray.
Yeah.
That they were devout Jews, and they had a very structured form of prayer and worship and sacrifice. And that they asked him, teach us how to pray, is a very curious question to me, that they wanted to go deeper. They wanted to go more personal, I guess. I don't know. I'm just always curious about how people respond to the initiative to pray. Most of us, you know, we pray when something, we're in the form of a crisis, or we want something, or we feel we need something. You know, I saw interesting thing the other day in the paper. Somebody, one of the candidates was asked where God was when 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And he said, well, there's good and there's evil in the world, and we have to be aware of that. Well, my response to that would have been that God was in the towers.
Mm.
God was present to each individual going through that horrible,
right,
facing their own death individually and with a community.
Right.
That God
right.
is present in our deepest hungers and our worst times, as well as our best. But we often are forced to pray in ways that we can never articulate in bad times. How often the expression is, oh, my God, when we see something
yeah.
good or evil. You know, the expression is the same. Oh, my God, you know. So I'm just curious
yeah.
about that.
Ask how yeah. prayer works for you, and has that changed across your lifetime? Is it different now than it was 20 years ago?
Oh yeah, it changes almost daily. I feel it's the one time where I am commanded to use my imagination, because that I think is where it starts, isn't it?
Yes,
is with the imagination. So what do you imagine? What are you seeing? What are you feeling? What are you driving towards? Where are you during that period of prayer? That's the thing that fascinates me. For me, the central energy of it, I guess, is at communion, at the Eucharist.
Yes.
And for the most part, I'm just so stunned and so joy-filled that for the most part, I just say thank you.
Right.
Thank you for your presence. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm terrified of flying. I still am not comfortable on planes.
Gosh.
I'm always get the beads out and making endless, hopeless promises. You know, get us up safely now. Oh, thank you, Lord. Thank you. And put the beads away. And then comes the turbulence and I get the beads out again. Oh, Lord, please get rid of this. I'll do this. I'll do that. Oh, Lord, be present to me. But, you know,
right.
just so terrified of flying.
You must have
and one day
somewhere.
We were filming in Washington on the West Wing. We were filming for days and days and long days, some 12, 14-hour days. And I was exhausted at the end of the week. And I got to the airport and way early. And they said, would you like to board? Now, I would, I said. And I got in and buckled up and went fast asleep. And the next instant, I was jolted awake. The plane was roaring down the runway, just ready to lift off. And I bolted awake and I said, thank you. It's been wonderful. I couldn't have asked for anything more. I couldn't have been loved more. I couldn't have loved more. Thank you. And if we don't make it back safely, be present to those who will miss me the most.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you. It's been wonderful. And that's my prayer, is to give thanks and praise, you know.
Yeah.
So, to kind of answer you, I guess that's what it is. For me, it's like, how did I get here? How was I so lucky to get here? thank you. Mm. And I just accept it and give thanks and praise and keep walking. You know, I remember we were shooting a scene in the way one night, and we were racing against the sunlight, and it was the sun was sinking over the mountains, and Emilio had this shot in mind, and he raced us all up to the top of this mountain and put our backpacks on, and he said, "Now go! I'm going to film you walking down the mountain." And one of the players yelled, "Well, what is our motivation?" And Emilio turned around and said, "To give thanks and praise, of course." And he went back and shot the scene. That's what most of our lives are.
There it is.
Give thanks and praise.
Yeah. Well, then, so let's go there. Let's talk about the way and the pilgrimage. Because, you know, you've also said one of the ways you describe, you know, who is Martin Sheen? Who is Ramon Estevez? You are a pilgrim. Now, the road to Santiago de Compostela is this famous pilgrimage. And now, did you go there? Did you do the pilgrimage separately from making the movie?
Or
you did part of it, right?
Well, I tell you what happened. Mm-hmm. My grandson, Taylor, who was working for me as an assistant, in 2003, we had a family reunion in Ireland, and I invited everybody to come with us to Spain and do the Camino. Well, it was a fantasy. I hadn't practiced. I didn't have enough time. I didn't even know the specifics of the route, and I had
no idea what is 800 kilometers?
It's 800 kilometers. It's 500 miles. Yeah. And it's 1,000 years old. Blah blah blah. My father was a Gallego. He was born not too far, about 70 kilometers from Santiago. He was from Vigo, and so I knew about the Camino, but I didn't know it personally. And so we got to Spain, and we were trying to figure out, should we walk it? Should we take horses or what? How do we do this? Or we ride bicycles. And finally, my sister, Carmen, who lives in Spain, and she's a teacher there, and she said, "Look, why don't you rent a car and drive the Camino? Because you don't have enough time." I had to be back in 2 weeks to start the new season of the West.
It's cheating, but okay.
Yeah. So we started to drive it, and we got to Burgos, the town which is where the boys stole my bag, if you remember the movie. And we stayed in this refugio, which was really called a casa rural, a home in the country for pilgrims. And it was called El Molino, the mill. And my grandson, Taylor, and I were seated at the table at the pilgrim supper that night with Matt Clark, my dear friend who played the priest in the film.
Okay.
And the three of us are sitting there, and this very beautiful young girl comes along serving supper. She worked there. Her parents ran this refugio. She looked at Taylor, my grandson. My grandson Taylor looked at her, Julia, and they've been looking at each other ever since.
They got married.
They're married.
Right?
He lived there for 9 years. They live here now.
Yeah.
But that was it. And so Emilio felt that he had lost a son on the Camino, and he began going over to visit him studying the Camino and reading about it. And finally he came up with this story. Yeah, but that's how it started, yeah.
It's very resonant. I mean, I know it's a joyful way of losing a son, but the film is about the loss of a son and you kind of making the pilgrimage with his ashes. But it is interesting that it was also a pilgrimage into your family roots. I mean, back into
both
of your names, Martin and Ramon.
Yes, it was, you know, no one had ever been given permission to film inside the cathedral.
Oh, I didn't know
in
that.
Santiago, yeah. Only newsreel footage and documentaries. They never allowed a production company in there to actually film a drama. But we prevailed upon them and said we were very respectful, and we were Spanish, and we were Catholic, and we were wanted to celebrate this. And so, they let us in. They lit the cathedral for us and let us film the Mass and the Buto Femero, you know, the huge incense burner that flies across from ceiling to ceiling. And, and it was and then we finished the film in Muxia, where he dumped the final residue from the ashes, you know. But yeah, that was an extraordinary time for us. We filmed it in a sequence. You know, we started in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port and walked over the Pyrenees and arrived in Spain and then walked the rest of it. We filmed for about 10 weeks on the Camino, and we were lucky enough to get good weather and very little rain. which everyone told us would not happen. But this was just one of the miracles along the way. But, you know, pilgrimage, although it's a physical endeavor, for the most part, it's an interior pilgrimage. It's an interior journey, and all the pilgrims who've ever done it have come to that realization. It's you're walking physically. That's something you're doing outside, but there's something else going on inside, and it's the journey to your true self, I think. You know, we begin to realize because we're quiet and focused in a way that we normally are not, you know. So you get 6, 8, 10 weeks on pilgrimage to learn about yourself and to celebrate your life, you know.
Well, this is so wonderful. I just want to ask you a couple more questions.
Sure.
I want to go back a little bit to the West Wing. You said that it was such an incredible experience, personally, professionally, and spiritually. How would you talk about, for you, that how that was a spiritually significant, playing that role and being part of that series?
Well, what we do for a living, that is artists, you know, we live on the energy of our imagination. Our imagination projects us to fulfill our work. And it is the one sure measure of authenticity is to use your imagination to explore realities. And so working as an actor on the West Wing, reflecting the most powerful office in the world, it seemed to me the most important thing was to project the humanity of that office, and that whoever occupied it had a responsibility to be more human than anyone else around him, and to trust instinct, the instinct of your humanness, to embrace all of the brokenness and the insecurities and the fear and anxiety, and to trust in something higher, that as long as you were doing your best to be honest and forthright, that you would come out on even ground. And I trusted that as an actor. And I discovered very early on that if I used different language than what had been written by Aaron Sorkin, I felt it was more realistic. Well, I'm more Martin. Martin would say this. And
right.
I said, yeah, well, okay. And he and I would get into discussions about it because he has a reputation, you know, of, you know, being very strict about using his words. And I mean every one of them.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to embrace that. And when I finally did and got out of his way with the language, I realized that it was not Martin. It was Bartlett.
Okay.
When I used his language, that then I was free to be that character. But I had to surrender myself and at the same time bring all of myself to it. There was a scene one time he actually I thought it was a mistake, but in the script he had me literally banging my head on the desk in the Oval Office. And I said, I can't do this. Aaron, I'm sure you made a mistake. He said, no, if you do it, you'll see. And just like all imaginative artists, yeah, I was ruled by him, and I did it. And it was the only thing that I could do in the scene that reflected how the president felt at that moment, banging his head on his desk. That's a small example. But whenever I surrendered to him and to his image of what the president was doing and thinking at that moment, it always, always worked. And so I was not working in a vacuum. I had confidence in what I was doing, and I embraced his image with my imagination. And so the two of us were free to explore this guy named Jed Bartlett.
I actually wondered how you felt about lighting up a cigarette in a church.
Oh, my. That was not easy because, you know, that's a national cathedral.
Yeah.
And you know what? When we filmed that in the National Cathedral, I was very, very, very reluctant to do that But it was only when I did it that I understood how important it was. Here was a man who was facing despair, who was in a dialogue with the Almighty. That takes a pretty good imagination and a big ego to pull that off. And I remember the curators of the church were very upset about what I did. And between takes, I was talking to them, and I said, I get the sense that you're not happy with what I'm doing here. And they said, absolutely not. We think it's disgraceful and it ought not be done. And I said, yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm sorry you're subject to this. And then I looked up, and exactly above my head was a stained glass image in the window of Job.
Right.
And I said, what a coincidence. Look at that guy up there. That's what I am down here today. Yeah. It's Job crying out to God, how could you do this to me?
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know,
right.
it was so biblical.
Yeah.
It was so ingrained in the Jewish community to have an open dialogue with God.
Right.
That
it's also not at
prayer,
all hard to imagine that Job would have lit up a cigarette if he could have.
Yes, he would have. Yes. And stomped around
right,
in the sanctuary.
Right.
Yes. Yes. It's very, very traditionally Jewish, which I loved, you know, and I got to do it in a Catholic church.
Yeah. Yeah. But it must be interesting, too, that you so inhabited that role. And I do. It does seem like people kind of treat you like a former president. Am I right? I mean, when I looked around, I saw that you were being interviewed on the BBC about race in America after Ferguson. And I know that's about you and everything you've done, but I also think there's this stature that you have that. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I would say that's the image. That's not the reality. I don't consider my stature any different than my neighbor. But I have a public persona. I also have a responsibility. And whether I had played Bartlett or not, I would still try to rise to accepting the responsibility of speaking out on any of these issues that I felt were important, you know, to take a stand on.
Yeah, but it's kind of an extraordinary thing that you were offered this role, that you inhabited, and that it has become part of your identity.
Yeah, that's interesting. I kind of, you know, it's been 10 years since the show ended its run. It's still seen, you know, on some of the...
it's on Netflix.
Netflix, yeah. Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But I kind of closed the door when I left that set, mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of left it there. It's what it is. When it was,
mm-hmm.
It's not now,
mm-hmm.
And I can't say that the show had any influence on anyone that ever watched it. But I can't determine if it did not. I just really don't know. I heard later that really it had a very strong effect on young people, and particularly young women. Who got involved?
Getting into politics,
got involved in public life, at least, you know, or went on to public service. That's what I think of politics. Politics is kind of almost a rude word to be accused of something. Always a politician, you know. How unfortunate, you know. But the word public service is the way I would describe people who run for office or who serve, you know.
Yeah.
That's the higher calling, you know. That I think transcends politics. If you think of it as public service,
well,
and so that's kind of what if the show, The West Wing, helped to inspire people to public service, that's very gratifying. But you know, in large part, it's Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah,
it was his vision. we didn't come in and make any of that up.
Yeah. Although there are these moments where there was the Shibboleth episode where...
Shibboleth. Yeah,
yeah, where you, as a prisoner, interviewing this Chinese Christian asylum seeker, skeptically.
Yeah.
And there's this line, Mr. President, where he says to you, Mr. President, Christianity is not demonstrated by a recitation of facts, which so sounds to me like something you would have written, you know, that it resonated absolutely with who you are. I don't know.
Well, there was so much of the show and so many of the issues that I did take deeply a personal interest in. There were some that I did not. You know, I'm opposed to the death penalty, and I've been an outspoken advocate for opposition to the death penalty, capital punishment.
Yeah.
And so there was an episode where I had to decide to give this guy a reprieve or not on a federal case.
Yeah.
The president, I think the last president that actually did it was John Kennedy. So that's how long ago it was. And that issue faced Bartlett. And Aaron couched it with him praying the rosary in the Oval Office and having a conversation with his pastor, who was played by Carl Malden, and talked about it. And I personally am opposed to the death penalty. And I told Aaron, I said, let's have Bartlett let this guy off. He said, no, that's not going to happen. And so I called my lawyer, Joe Cosgrove, who was in that episode, incidentally.
Okay.
As an attorney. Yeah. And he said, well, yeah, Martin would let him off, but Bartlett wouldn't. It's a political decision.
I see.
And I said, oh, my God, yeah. I don't get to make these decisions, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was couched in a moral frame of reference. It cost him dearly to make that decision or not to make that decision, to let him go, to let him live. You know, he paid for it in a deeply personal way. And that was the kind of thing that I always, always loved about the show, that nothing came cheap, that there were no easy answers, no quick solutions. It was costly. And as I said earlier, I think anything worthwhile has got to cost us something. And if it doesn't, we're left to question its value.
Right.
So I had a lesson in politics that it was very hard to swallow.
Well,
that Bartlett let that guy go, that didn't sit well with me. But that was the political decision. You know?
Yeah.
That was the reality of the office. Yeah.
Where is your... Where's your passion, your curiosity directed right now? Where are you feeling called to this spiritual discipline of human presence in what's happening in the world now?
Well, it's so clear in the horrible situations in the Mideast and so many countries, particularly Syria. We've watched this horror unravel. There is no Syria. It has become a living hell that people are trying to get out of. It's just that this descent into this level of inhumanity, of this level of insanity, is clear to the whole world. We just watch in horror, and more violence creates more violence, and we seem thrown back into despair. Each time we move forward, we face despair. And yet, looking at the lives coming out of that horror, these extraordinary people who risk their lives getting out and then risk their lives trying to cross Europe, trying to get to a safe haven and to be subject to so much what I call basically, you know, vulgarity, you know, that they,
that's a good
they're
word.
Being stopped from coming in here or going where they can be safe. I would think that the answer to the horrors that we witnessed recently in Paris would be to open our arms even wider and embrace even more and say, this is our answer to this insanity. And I, without a a beat. I wish I could have selected this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner. It would have been Miss Merkel of Germany.
Yeah, right.
She opened the doors and just left them open. Mm. And she was a great source of inspiration to all of us. She still is. Mm-hmm. She hasn't backed down. Mm-hmm. They're being a little more careful. But the fact that she opened the doors and kept them open, that's a reflection of how we used to be. That was our country. In the last century, you know, we made ourselves on the labor.
As a son of immigrants. A son of immigrants from two different countries. Also,
So that's the one overriding issue that I'm immensely concerned about and that I am troubled by.
And the Christian response to me seems so clear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't see any gray area with this one.
No,
the orphan, the outcast, the stranger.
Yeah, this is the cup
any room
is offered,
for interpretation.
Not altered. No,
sorry.
It is not. Yeah. No, this is what we know what we should do, you know. And when we get political and we get frightened and we get selfish, then we do stupid things and we lose our humanity.
Mm. You said somewhere, or wrote, I think, I don't know what salvation means in a personal sense. For me, a better word is freedom. Which I think for you is connected with this idea that you keep bringing home about. I mean, isn't it ironic that the work of a lifetime is being more human, really becoming human? But talk to me about what
human,
how the language of freedom. You know, open that up for me. What that means and how that plays into your sense of.
Well, another word for freedom, I guess, is responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know. Is looking at a situation, whether it's deeply a personal one or a family or community or nation, you know, it is one where we step up to responsibility. We embrace responsibility. The freedom cannot be trifled with on any level, whether it's national or personal. It is a reflection of the imagination in all things human. We are born, and we are encouraged to strive towards freedom, always. Because that's the only way that we can identify ourselves. I think one of the worst problems for young people these days, and it's very clear to me that they carry it into adulthood, this terrible feeling of peer pressure. It's how will I look if I step out, and yet my heart tells me so. Or how will I look if she disapproves or he doesn't think I'm doing the right thing, and yet my heart tells me I must do this because that's the only way that I know myself. Mm-hmm. And that is very costly. And it is the door, really, to a deeper sense of self-knowledge. If I know when I'm not free, then I will always strive for freedom. Hmm. We get examples of this of people living in repressive societies. What kept them going? Their imagination of being free. Knowing that it was possible that someday they would be free, and never, ever losing sight of that, that that's worthy of our human struggle, that that's something that to lay it all on the line for, that it's such a deeply personal thing, and yet it's reflected in our national product, if you will, in our universal image of ourselves,
and,
this determination to live free, to live honest.
And yet, in spiritual terms, you know, you're not, when you talk about your core of gratitude and community and love and these things as the basis for your action, I mean, you're not talking about freedom as autonomy or isolation or mere independence. I mean, it might have a quality of independence. You're talking about freedom as connected to community in some way, I think.
Yes, exactly.
That's what I hear coming through.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It is so often people get stuck, and I did myself, on the spiritual journey, if you will, with piety. And that is a terrible stumbling block. I have nothing against piety, but I think that piety is the road. It is not the destination. Mm. If being pious leads you to a form of personal reflection and acceptance of a higher power, then it has its purpose. But it has to be discarded in the larger picture in favor of the community. Because piety is something that you do or you tend to do alone. Mm. And true freedom, spirituality, can only be achieved in community. Hmm. Even if the community is only imagined. I mean, someone living in a cell by themselves, alone in repression, in the darkest of times, still, they are in community. That's the wonderful thing, that image that Catholicism uses and refers to as the communion of saints, that even after we're gone, we're still a part of something that's very much alive and we respond to, you know. Mm. And our church, you know, is, thank heaven for this extraordinary man, Francis, who is teaching us that our church has to be less a museum for saints than it should be a hospital for sinners.
Okay.
You know. But that's I love the community of saints and sinners. You can't really separate them, you know. You can't identify one without the other, which is wonderful because that's community.
Yeah.
You know? But I feel a part of a community even when I'm distanced from it, you know.
Yeah.
The greatest mysteries are the simplest ones. Those are the ones that we confront every day. I had a conversation once with a priest. I was traveling and went to confession in this very remote place, and this guy, and it was wonderful. We were having a theological conversation in the confessional, and suddenly he said, "Well, we don't know what God is, do we?" and he said it as if, well, you know, maybe I ran into someone who did. You know, I'm not going to foreclose that possibility.
Right.
But,
and
you know, what it says is every time we try to identify God, we are sure to identify what she is certainly not.
Yeah.
But so we don't know what God is, and the genius of God to dwell where we would least likely look, within the depths of our own being, our own shallowness, our own darkness, our own humanity. That's the genius of God. And that may have been the only change in the universe since its inception.
Well, Martin Sheen, Ramon Estevez, thank you so much for this beautiful conversation. It's been wonderful to meet you.
Thank you very much. Now you know what a windbag I am.
You are wonderful, and you're perfect for radio, because that's what it's about, the voice.
Communicating. I've so enjoyed this. Thank you so much, and I'm a huge fan of yours.
Oh, well, thank you.
We're looking forward to this.
Yeah, we will. We're going to produce this, I think, right away, and we will we'll keep you informed about when we send you the podcast. You'll be able to listen, and it's just very exciting. And I also think I have a show I want to send you where somebody talked about prayer in a wonderful way, so I'll have a little send that.
Yeah. I would look forward to
Okay.
That. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.